actually, it was one of mine, he said.
I apologize for being somewhat late. I was going to share this with you, but in the interest of time, I'll go ahead and start. Got started over to her house to pick her up and had a low tire on the car. And had to turn around and go get another car. And then got started out here and decided I better run back by the house. And so that's the problem.
Sound like you left kind of early because you had a lot to do.
Well, yeah, we leave about 5 after 8 to go get her, you know, because we're 20 minutes from there, and then we got to go get her, and that's about 20 minutes. Okay, we're almost through. The poem is almost behind us. We lack chapters 40 and 40 through 42. Before we look at these last three verses, I want to give a kind of an overview. I think will clarify, it does me anyway, to what the poem is saying. If you look at Job's life, you think of it in three phases, okay? First phase, Job is healthy, he's wealthy, he's happy. And all three of those things in extreme measure, you know. Wealth-wise, he is the Bill Gates of his day, okay? He has everything a man needs to make him happy. He has wife and kids. He has people that love him. I'm not sure 10 kids would make me happy, but he's happy with 10 kids. Then in phase two, he is a very sick man. He's lost his health.
It's okay.
He's probably in a pretty hopeless situation. He probably has no hope of ever getting better. He's lost all of his money. He's now in poverty. He's lost everybody that loves him and that he loves. His children are all dead, and his wife's told him to drop dead. He's suffering physically and emotionally and spiritually. He's grieving. It just is the worst you can do. Everything has gone wrong. And all he has is three friends that are tormenting him by telling him that what's happened to him is his fault. And he says they're miserable comforters. Then in phase three, Job's restored to health, wealth, and happiness. The same as phase one, only more so. And I think that, man, I think that Job probably thought that in phase one, God was blessing him because he was such a good servant. He thought God was pleased with him. And Job was right, God was pleased with him. But I don't think that's why God had put a fence around him. Okay? We know from the poem, things that were said, that in phase two, Job thought that God was displeased with him. He didn't know why. He thought God was punishing him. God had denied him justice for no reason, and Job could discern no reason for it. And he's demanding an explanation from God. However, I don't think that when you get to phase three, Job thought that God restored him because he was a good servant. Okay, I think he had changed his perspective of who God was and his relationship with God. I think it was Jim McGuigan's book that I haven't read it yet, but I'm getting there. He said the God that Job was complaining about didn't exist. He thought God was a good, loyal friend, and God had let him down, okay? Job had kept his end of the bargain, and God hadn't kept his end. But if you look at what this poem says, without inferring or adding or explaining God, in phase one, Job had all his blessings because God, in his sovereignty, had put a protective fence around Job so that God, Satan couldn't get to him. In phase two, God, in his sovereignty, lowered the protective fence and allowed Satan to ruin Job. And in phase three, God, again, as a sovereign God, put the protective fence back up. So in a way, the poem is a commentary on the sovereignty of God. You can learn a lot about the sovereignty of God by meditating and thinking on what the poem says. At the end of phase two, Job is standing before God in a storm, and he has an epiphany. He has a revelation, I think, that God is not punishing him. Job was suffering. Job's suffering was not evidence that God was displeased with him in phase two, nor were his blessings in phase one necessarily because he was a good servant. Okay? And I think that's the reason at the end of chapter 42, Job says, "My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you." I think his whole understanding of God was new and different, more correct, more mature, and more accurate. We often read this story like this. We say, God was blessing Job because he was a good servant. Then God took away the blessings because he wanted to see what Job would do. Then God restored the blessings because Job didn't curse God. Okay? That's attributing a lot of things to God that this poem doesn't attribute to God. It's a misrepresentation, I think, of what the poem says. I think that everything that God did in Job's life in all three phases was because God was sovereign. It was not in any way because of what God, Job, did or didn't do. Okay? The author of the poem never says that God put the fence around Job because he was a good servant. Nor did God remove the fence because he needed to demonstrate that Job wouldn't curse him to his face. I think God knew what Job would do. I think he had a lot of confidence in Job. But finally, the poem doesn't say that God restored the fence to reward Job for a job well done.
You don't think when he makes a comparison that Job, there's nobody like him in the earth, and then Satan says, well, you protected him.
Yes.
There's a terribly close correlation. It's hard to say that these two don't go together.
Well, yeah, I know. He does say that in phase two, Satan incited him.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Which suggested he was otherwise incited, if you're motivated,
But I don't think that what I'm saying is God wasn't rewarding Job for being a good servant in phase one. He wasn't punishing Job in phase two, and he wasn't rewarding him again in phase three. God, it was not because of Job's behavior. Okay, that's the point I'm making. I read something in a book one time a long time ago that said the poem would be more true to life if the author had let Job die while he was sitting on the ash heap. You know, not only would he never be restored, but he would never know why what happened to him happened to him. Because that's more true to life. But think about it. The poem is a story of a man's life. I think it has a historical thing, and I think that the author documented what happened to Job. And, you know, in James chapter 5, let me turn there that quick, like, if Job had died on the ash heap without any knowledge of why it happened to him, James couldn't write in chapter 5 hundreds and hundreds of years later that, you know, he says, as you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and seen what God finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. So That wouldn't be in the New Testament if Job had died on the ash heap, if God had not brought something about at the end of the suffering. Another point I want to make is, I think that Job is, in some sense, the story of mankind. You know, we all are Jobs. We all have blessings in our life and curses in our, you know, suffering in our life. We have a friend in Kentucky that's I've referred to, and I've told her this, so I don't think I'm giving away any confidence. I said, you're a modern-day Job. Because as a young woman, she and her husband were happily married. Both had good jobs out of college, and they had one child. And suddenly, he got spinal meningitis and died. She was expecting the second child when he died. And spinal meningitis is very treatable. You know, it's just a medical negligence that she lost her husband. And then later in life, she lost one of her daughters in a car wreck. You know, I've not lost that kind of loved ones yet, you know. I've referred to her as a modern-day Job. So there's a little bit of Job in all of us, you know. Maybe God's protective fence is not so complete, completely up and then completely down and completely back up, but we've all got a protective fence around us, don't we? To the extent that we have good things in our life, it's because God has in His sovereignty, has agreed to do that.
Decided.
Do what?
Decided to do that. I don't think agreement on our part has anything
right.
to do
with You're it. Right. Decided. God has decided to do that. That's not, we're not in a covenant relationship with God relative to suffering. That's true. He has promised us things. And that's one of the things I get out of the poem. He's made us a lot of promises, but He has not promised us that we're going to have an easy life. Let me ask you, think about this for a minute. You've got three phases, three Jobs, phase one, phase two, and phase three. Which one do you identify the most with? Job phase one? Or it's kind of hard to identify with phase one if you're an older person, but Lorelei might. Although I know Lorelei has suffered because she had a lot of problems. She spent a lot of times in the hospital when she was a little girl. Anybody, what Job do you identify with?
Depends on what day.
On what day? good point, yeah. I think, you know, Janice and I were baptized in 1975. And I don't think God ever bragged to Satan about me that I'm the best of the best or anything. But I've tried to be a child of God for 47 years, 48 years. I've had good health. I've had reasonably good financial success. I've had a good wife for how many years? 56. I've had two daughters, two son-in-laws, and six grandchildren. So I've got a lot of things I can point to that I've got in common with Job in phase one, you know. In phase two, I hadn't suffered like Job.
You had a lot of heartache with your family.
Yeah, a lot of grief there.
And you did have heart surgery.
Yeah, I counted up. I had five surgeries in about 7 years. I had never had any surgery till I was about 62, and then five surgeries. I had three times on my neck, once on my chest, once on my groin. I was getting tired of getting cut on, you know. So I've suffered there some. And the bypass surgery, they assured me, oh, you'll go in and you'll go home in 2 days. And it didn't happen for me.
Everything happened that could happen.
Yeah. So, I've suffered. I don't think I've suffered as hopelessly as Job did. And I haven't had an epiphany from God. Is that the correct word, an epiphany, a revelation? To stand up, to see a great manifestation of God. My understanding of God and my relationship with God has been much more slowly developing okay, I was Bible study and almost 50 years of being a Christian. Phase three, well, I don't know if anybody can be in phase three without having an epiphany, but I'd like to think I'm older and wiser, but it's debatable about being wiser, you know. But I've never had the fence completely lowered, and I don't think I've ever had a fence that was protected me as completely as Job did in phase one and three. So, but yeah, I can identify with all three Jobs. I think anybody can.
You don't think that suffering, I mean, even when you have God and stuff, as far as, to me, suffering brings strength. Mm-hmm. And then it's, you know, if believing in Christ is really short-lived. We don't suffer because we know we're going to come out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, with God's love, it's going to be happiness.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of benefits to having suffered, and perseverance is one of them, as James says, you know. You remember the comic strip from last week? You don't mature, you don't grow up without suffering, you know. So it reminds me, we were driving through Iowa one time, and the wind was blowing, and the wheat was going like this. It's fully mature wheat.
Just and we were on a motorcycle, and we were going like this.
But yeah, we stopped and said something in a restaurant, and they said, oh yeah, that's buffeting of the wheat is what makes it strong and what gets it there, you know. So anyway, I think we're all like Job to a certain extent. Any other comments before we go back to the text?
I was just thinking.
Oh,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Judy.
I might be wrong, but I've always thought of the head as something that was just in Satan's mind. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, all these physical blessings you put there, God, as something that protects him from despair, mm-hmm. from going into the life that Job was experiencing after he was suffering so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he always had a hedge up around him like we do. We always have God's presence, God's, you know, all the important eternal blessings that are a hedge for us. So I don't know. To me, there was not a hedge that was taken up and down.
That's a good thought. I hadn't thought of that. But to the extent that we have blessings, God is providing them, right?
Sure, so, but when they're taken away, we don't have any less of a hedge to me.
Well, I agree with that, because I think God was not punishing Job, but, you know, Satan couldn't get at him. Satan couldn't get at him as long as God was there in his sovereignty, keeping Satan from getting at Job. And that, to me, that's the hedge.
Satan
was prohibited. It's not a big argument.
And I don't have a problem with that, because I do see God's blessings on Job in phase one, two, and three. But yeah, you were saying something.
Well, like you're saying, he was prohibited from doing certain things, and that therein was constituted a protection or a hedge against Job. And then spiritual, in two different realms. One is, could he damage him in his relationship with God, that God would judge him as unrighteous? Well, no, he couldn't come in and change that. That was always there.
Mm-hmm.
But he could. God did allow him to do things that would impact Job physically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm jumping. Go
ahead.
Well, jumping in line.
We've kind of gone around the bush, but I was just thinking, we need some sorrow in our lives to really appreciate the joys. Mm. If everything was just like this,
yeah,
I don't think we would appreciate it as much.
Mm. And there have been great literature written about that, in fact. Mm-hmm.
I used to, in cards for newlyweds, mm. I would say that I prayed that there would be just enough sorrow in their lives that they could appreciate the many joys and blessings.
There's a short story in there called The Cave or something, where...
The Cave, I don't remember that one.
Well, maybe it's another story.
What's it about?
It's about a guy comes to a valley, a city where everybody's blind. And nobody knows what it's like to have sight. And he has sight. And he tries to communicate to them what sight is. And they have no appreciation whatsoever of sight. And I think they wind up killing him or something.
I think Tennyson amplifies things that we value up against sorrow when he said, I know 'tis true, whatever befall, I feel it when I sorrow most. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. So that's what Drew's talking about.
Yes.
You wouldn't have that value if you didn't know it up against the sorrow. And he said when he sorrowed most, he felt most like that.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't be able to help others and understand them if we hadn't gone through some of this ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be just like, well,
it's
just,
and I think that, I don't know exactly what Jesus meant when he said, they said, why is this man born blind? And he said, well, he's born blind so we'll know the glory of God, right? Or we'll see the works of God. I had a guy one time say, you mean to tell me he made him blind so the rest of us could...
No, I don't think it's that simple.
I don't think it's that he made him blind, but I think we can see the value of sight if we're aware. If nobody was blind, we wouldn't know what it was like to be blind. And I saw another right here.
When I was younger, I really struggled reading Job. It was just too hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed not fair, there's that word. But anyhow, even though he was restored and all of that, and always if you stick with it, it gets better. But the part about this, maybe you can give me some insight, that seems the hardest part of this book is it feels like God is sitting at a table with Satan with a bag of chips or something, and they're talking about his life as if it puts a review on man that is frightening to me.
Yeah. I think that's the point you made earlier in the class, that God and Satan are having a wager up here in heaven, and Job's the recipient of it.
Right.
That imagery is there. But I don't think that's the intent of the poem. And you said two things. Next week, we're going to talk about some lessons we get from. One of them is life's not fair.
Right.
Life is not fair. And if we struggle to make life fair, or to for ourselves at least, we'll have a frustrating life. We have to just accept that life is not fair. And I forgot that other point you made. But
just the fact that this... I think there's a Star Trek from the early days where two people are sitting at a table talking about what they're going to do to this individual that's down on another planet or something.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about it that has a feeling, I guess the only feeling that feels similar is when Satan is talking to Jesus from the mountaintop and from the... And you're thinking, how's this working? Are they in separate universes? Are they really at a table? Are they really talking verbally? Are they talking mentally? There's just more not understood than there is understood.
Yeah, it's a mystery.
And all of that, the picture I get is, we don't know a whole lot. We know a lot about God, but we don't know everything about God. And we don't know everything about Satan either. We know a lot about him. But to me, that picture up there is, thank God, God is handling Satan. And Jesus, thank goodness, Jesus handled Satan. And so, when I feel like Satan's handling me, then I cry out to them.
Yeah. Okay. But there is that imagery of the Greek gods, up here getting in an argument with one another, and man on earth is suffering the consequences. Well, that imagery is there in the poem, but it's different, I think. A different lesson.
That's just what you see, though.
Yeah.
That's not all of it.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Job. Try to finish it today, because I'll read the first five verses. You remember before this, God had asked Job, I counted 53 questions in chapter 38 and 39. 53 questions that God asked Job. He says, the Lord said to Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. Then Job answered the Lord, I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I have no more to say. So here God accuses, this is round two of God's confronting Job, putting Job on trial. He accuses him of two things. He says, you're contending with God and you're accusing God. Notice in verse 8, we'll read it in a minute, it says, would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? So that's Job's sin. That's the thing that Job is doing that's very presumptuous in his relationship.
And that's one of the things that addresses somewhat Laura's talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what changed? He, you know, Job has been raging mad for 30-something chapters at God, and then God asks him a bunch of questions that he can't answer, and Job's kind of given up. You know, he says, I can't answer you, God. I don't have an answer. Well, did Job just browbeat? Did God browbeat Job into submission, or what? And this is where I think the epiphany is, okay?
He revealed himself to him.
Yeah. I don't think that the questions that Job couldn't answer brought about his change of attitude, okay? There's some possibilities. You think about it, it's got to be, you're standing in the presence of God. And you see God in all His glory and His majesty. He sees love and compassion of God. And he sees that God's nature. He realizes that God is not a God who would punish him for no reason. He may not understand. He may not understand, but he accepts the motives that he had been ascribing to God are incorrect. And I thought about this, you know, Elihu kind of put Job on trial before God spoke. And Job hadn't spoken until now. And Elihu, I think, did a pretty good job of defending God. God's not going to defend himself to anybody. He's sovereign. But Job gives, Elihu gives Job some pretty good reasons for suffering other than God is punishing you because he's unhappy with you. And so maybe Job has been thinking about what Elihu said, and now that God speaks, he's responding to both God and Elihu.
I just wonder if the epiphany is, I guess in a way it's more because he's hearing God speak directly to him, where we don't do that.
Yeah.
But we come to realization.
Yeah.
And part of the realization is the fact that God is in charge. He is sovereign, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
I don't care how much you don't like it, you can't do a thing about it. So you either fight it or you choose to accept it.
Yeah, that's what it is about life's not fair. You can fight it, but it's not going to do you any good to fight it.
Whatever he decides is what happens, so you might as well get on his side, if, you know, do their best to do what makes him happy. But that doesn't mean you don't live with problems and issues and lots of pain from the life you experience. I don't think Job's pain ever went away.
No, I don't either. But if you think about it,
emotional.
The fact that the God of the universe would speak to you and talk to you in order to straighten you out, you have to realize that God loves you, right? I mean, the God of the whole universe takes a few moments to come and talk to you personally, that's a personal God, right? And I think Job realized that.
But he didn't say anything nice to him, did he?
No. No, he didn't.
To me, I want to hear, I want to hug, you know?
Yeah. That's a good point, yeah. Okay, let's read chapter 40 through verse 14. We can start with verse 6. Somebody read that for the class. 6 through 14.
Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? And can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you.
Okay. In verse 8, you know, two more accusations from God. He says, you discredit my justice. Would you condemn me to justify yourself? I think verses 9 through 14, there's a lot to be learned in those verses. God is saying, if Job can do what God does, control the universe, rule the universe, and what God wants, what Job wants God to do, that's punish the wicked every time they sin, then God will admit that Job can save himself. Otherwise, Job's going to have to depend on God for deliverance and salvation. You better put your faith in God, in other words. As I said, God's sovereign. He will decide when and how to reward and punish. Years ago, I read a book, I think it was probably in the 1980s, by Harold Kushner. The name of the book was When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Have you ever heard that book? He's a Jewish rabbi, I think, Rabbi Kushner. And he places a lot of emphasis on these verses, but I didn't like the way he worded it, you know. He said what God is saying to Job is, well, I did the best I could, God, Job. You know, the world is not a perfect place, but I did the best I could, and if you can make it better, try it. I didn't like that explanation. I'm not sure. I just don't like God ever being put in a position of doing the best he could, but not making, you know, not quite measuring up. And I don't think that's what God is saying to Job. I think that the world we have is the best of all possible worlds, given the reality of the fall of nature and the free will of man. If you consider that the nature has fallen with the events in Genesis 1 and 2 there, and man is sinful, he has free will and he can choose to do good or bad. I think that's what, you cannot have a world where, you know, you can look at every proud man and humble him and crush the wicked where they stand and bury them in the dust and then have a world with free will where nobody gets hurt. You see what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So I don't think God's saying I did the best I could. I think God's saying this is the way it is. This is the world we have. And it's, if you take away free will, you can only get rid of suffering if you take away free will. You cannot have free will and a fallen creation without having suffering.
You can also create a lot of suffering, take away free will. We've seen that from the totalitarian governments.
Yeah. So that's my understanding.
It's not as simple as man might think.
Do what?
I said it's not as simple as man might think.
Right. I'm going to take off on a side note here because I think this is worthwhile. I remember a point that book made about prayer that I really did like. The point is, we should not pray for alternate results for something that has already occurred. Does that make sense?
To change the past, is that what you just said?
Yeah. That's an illogical prayer. Mm-hmm. And the example that the book gives goes like this. You're driving in your neighborhood and you see a couple of blocks over a column of smoke where your house is, and you start praying immediately, God, don't let that be my house. Please don't let that be my house, and you rush over there. Well, it either is your house or is not your house. God's not going to change. He's not going to answer that prayer by putting the fire out and moving the fire engine to some other place. So it's an illogical prayer to pray for God to change the past in order to answer your prayer. So I think we need some teaching on how to pray. Because I hear a lot of prayer like that, prayer requests. Have you ever noticed that? I hear that all the time.
Give us another example. I don't think anybody seriously thinks they're going to change what's just happened.
Okay, well,
they're just wishing it wouldn't be their house, hoping it wouldn't be their house.
Yeah, that's true. Well, how about this? You might hear, I'm taking a college course, and I took a test last week, and I'm going to class in a minute to find out my grade. Pray that I pass that test. That's an illogical prayer request.
It's late.
But the professor's already graded your paper, and the grade is in the grade book.
Right.
And to answer that prayer the way you want it answered, God is not going to change the past.
What you got to pray is, help me to accept whatever verdict is.
That's what you should pray for. First off, you should pray that you pass before you take the test.
Yeah.
And second, if you take the test, pray that maybe in the future the professor will grade on a curve, or that everybody else did bad too, and you'll throw that test out. Pray for something else, but don't pray for the...
Pray for your prayer, make your prayers in order instead of...
Yeah.
Put them in the right order.
Well, we seem to think that if we don't know the outcome, God can change it until it's revealed to us. You ever noticed that?
Our youngest son several times called me from school right before he got ready to take a test and said, Mom, pray that I'll pass this test. And I said, I'm going to pray that you recall the things you've studied and be able to pass the test. And he began studying harder. And he did, he was a good student. But just for him to pass the test willy-nilly, he also prayed, wanted me to pray, that he'd be, I think it was 6'4".
6 foot four.
And black. And I said,
that. I think Adam told me about
and
that.
I said, why? And I said, and he said, because I think the Lord answers your prayer a little bit less than what you ask. And he wanted to be 6'3". And he thought the black fellas were better basketball players. I had to explain to him that probably he'd never be 6'3", and he wouldn't be any blacker than he got when he was out in the sun.
But, you know, you remember Linus in the Putty Funny Papers with Lucy wanted to go to a picnic on the next day, and she said, I hope to goodness it doesn't rain. And Linus, the little theologian, says, hoping to goodness is not good theology. Well, praying for God to change the past is not good theology. But like I said, we think that until I know what the outcome is, God can make it something other than what it already has been determined to be. And that, another thing, I thought about this, you know, I may say, I've got a pain in my side here that I'm going to go get some tests run, medical tests run. Pray that that's not cancer. Well, and you know, we think the medical test will determine if it's cancer. No, the medical test will reveal whether or not it's cancer. Whether or not it's cancer is already, you've got something there, and it may or may not be cancer. So you can pray, God, if this is cancer, heal me. You can pray, I hope my body heals me. I hope I learn to cope with this cancer if it's what it is. But don't pray for it not to be cancer when it is already determined that it's one thing or another. So I'm just saying we need to think about whether we're making sense in our prayer requests. Does that make sense? I see Adam going like this. So.
You know, this is powerful today. I had a meditation on prayer is not magic.
Right, yeah.
I'll bring it in quick if it's any good. I have to go back and read it again. It was good to me on the first contact.
Okay, let's read 40 verse 15 through 41. Two or three readers, two readers, one read from 40:15 through 41:11, and then somebody finish that chapter. Any volunteers?
I don't.
Okay.
Then yeah. I got the King James.
You got the King James?
No, it's a new King James.
Well, that'll work.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See how his strength is in his hips and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze, his ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play here. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade, the willows by the brook surround him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he's not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook, or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? With your companion, will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons, or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine.
Okay.
That's pretty straight.
You want me to read the next one?
God is really proclaiming his omnipotence.
Okay, is anybody going to read it? If not, I'll read it. Okay, I will not fail to speak of his limbs, his strength, and his graceful form. Who can strip off his outer coat? Who would approach him with a bridle? Who dares open the doors of his mouth, ringed about with his fearsome teeth? His back has rows of shields tightly sealed together. Each is so close to the next that no air can pass between. They are joined fast to one another. They cling together and cannot be parted. His snorting throws out flashes of light. His eyes are like the rays of dawn. Firebrands stream from his mouth. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke pours from his nostrils as from the boiling pot over a fire of reeds. His breath sets coals ablaze and flames dart from his mouth. Strength resides in his neck. Dismay goes before him. The folds of his flesh are tightly joined. They are firm and immovable. His chest is hard as rock, hard as the lower millstone. When he rises up, the mighty are terrified. They retreat before his thrashing. The sword that reaches him has no effect, nor does the spear, nor the dart, or the javelin. Iron he treats like straw, bronze like rotten wood. Arrows do not make him flee. Sling stones are like a chaff to him. A club seems to him but a piece of straw. He laughs at the rattling of the lance. His undersides are jagged potsherds, leaving a trail in the mud like a threshing sledge. He makes the depths churn like a boiling cauldron and stirs up the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him he leaves a glistening wake. One would think the deep had white hair. Nothing on earth is his equal, a creature without fear. He looks down on all that are haughty. He is the king over all that are proud. So God has described two of his creatures here, right? A behemoth and a leviathan. And he's basically said, I made these, Job. I made them for me, for my pleasure. They depend on me, and you are terrified in their presence. That you are totally insignificant. You know, have you ever experienced that? You know, have you ever come face to face with a vicious animal and you're defenseless? Have you ever had that happen?
I had a dog
one time, but if you grew up in the country, it's a lot better chance that happened to you than if you grew up in Huntsville in the 21st century, you know. But I was thinking about, if you ever have that feeling of terror, that's what Job would experience in the presence of Leviathan and Behemoth. And yet, they do God's bidding. He's proud of them. He created them. And they're nothing compared to him, you know. I thought of, Janice mentioned that we went to Wyoming on a motorcycle, 1995, I think it was. The intention was to go counterclockwise around Wyoming, start at the Devil's Tower and go to Yellowstone and then down and back across the Medicine Bow Range of the Rocky Mountains. We were entering Yellowstone National Park, and I noticed a couple of cars in front of me pulling off the side of the road, and we're on about an 800-pound motorcycle, Janice behind me, and down the road is two or three buffalo walking right at me, you know. And I'm thinking, these guys are in the cars, you know. We're sitting out here, and I couldn't turn that thing around if my life depended. I didn't have an option, you know. It was up to that buffalo. My life was in his hands, you know. And the terror just welled up in me, you know. And I'm just sitting there waiting to see what he's doing, going to do, because I can't do anything. You know, I'm helpless.
Then that's when you pray to God to control that buffalo.
he kept coming at me, and it's like I had eye contact with him. He's looking me right in the eye, you know. And he got about 10 yards from me, and he just slowly turned and lumbered off the side of the road, you know. And because I thought, this trip's going to end right here. We're going to go to the hospital, you know. So that's the kind of terror that I think Behemoth and Leviathan would put in any man's heart that try, you know, touch him and you won't do it again. That's what God says, you know.
Yeah.
I thought about this. This is another funny story. We were in Missouri, at Branson. In fact, Laurel and I and her younger brother were with us. and we'd stopped at a college town, I mean a college campus, to eat lunch. And we ate lunch, we thought, well, why don't we drive around the campus and see what's here? And we found a museum on the campus. And it had a lot of stuff in it, but it had a lot of stuffed animals in it. And I remember I was walking down a fairly dark hall to see if there was anything down there, and suddenly, to my right, I hear this deep, guttural growl. And I looked over there, and it was a Bengal tiger. A gigantic Bengal tiger. And I could have reached out and patted him on the head, you know. And they had put sound effects in this thing to make it sound realistic. But I was absolutely, I almost fainted, you know. My heart jumped up, and I thought, wait a minute now, this thing's got to be stuffed, you know. But I had no idea that a Bengal tiger is that gigantic. This thing was a huge cat. And I was, for a split second there, I was absolutely terrified. I think that's the kind of thing that you would encounter if you came before Leviathan or Behemoth. And I think they're probably a rhinoceros or a crocodile. I don't think, you know, one of the things we saw, they said maybe a mythological character. I don't think God would present to Job two things that were not his creation, that were myths, you know. So I think he's describing poetically and using imagery two horribly scary animals that God created. So that's we got about 3 minutes, and if it's okay with you, since I was late getting here and we talked about some stuff, why don't we read chapter 42 next week, and then we'll spend the time we have left with object lessons or life lessons from the book of Job. Okay? And that'll end the class.
Thank you.